Kurt Anderson is the host of Studio 360, which is heard on public radio. It's one of the great journalistic and interview programs in the United States. I listen to it every week on Saturday morning on WNYC. He is also the co-founder of Spy Magazine, a former editor of New York Magazine. He is a novelist. He's got a novel coming out next year, and he's a journalist. He writes for a variety of publications in New York, the New York Magazine, The New Yorker, and several others. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce our moderator for this evening, Kurt Anderson.
Thank you very much, Harold. I want to, again, thank BAM and the National Book Foundation for having this thing and for asking me to be part of it, and to all of you for coming. I didn't make a complete fool of myself last week, and so they've asked me to do it again, and here I am. It's probably untoward of me to say, because my job here is to talk, introduce, and talk to four novelists, but and those of you who come to other ones will not hear me say this. However, Julian Barnes is one of my favorite novelists writing today. Maybe I will say it other times if I get applause by saying that. But anyway, it's perfectly true. Like many of you, I'm sure, I discovered him only with his third book, and then had to go back and saw what I'd missed before. And he's so prolific, I've had to read a lot of books to keep up with him since. I am thrilled and excited every time he has a new book out, which fortunately is relatively often. I don't know if you read Arthur and George. I enjoyed it hugely, and we'll talk about that and the writer's life and what's the deal with France and many other things. But now it is my great privilege and honor to introduce Julian Barnes.
Thank you. I feel rather inadequate at not having anyone to introduce in my turn. But I guess I'm the end of the food chain. This is where it stops. I'm going to be reading for about a quarter of an hour from my novel, Arthur and George. Arthur is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, inventor of Sherlock Holmes. And I'm going to be reading an episode from his life. By 1893, when he was in his early mid-30s, Conan Doyle had been made rich, world-famous, and exasperated by Sherlock Holmes. Exasperated in the way that many writers are by their most famous creation. He felt that Sherlock Holmes and his success had overshadowed the rest of his work, and particularly what he thought of as his real work, his historical novels. And so in 1893, he decided to kill him off. Little did he know that this was to be a year which was stained with death for him. His father died, his wife was condemned to death, and his most famous creation was killed. So a fictional death, a real death, and a death foretold. It's perhaps not surprising that this was also the year in which he joined the Society for Psychical Research. When I say his wife was condemned to death, what happened was that she was diagnosed with tuberculosis. And given the state of her lungs, she was expected to live for about 3 months. Doyle, who had been a doctor himself, accepted the diagnosis but refused the prognosis. And by dint of extraordinary determination, money, the best doctors, regimes in Davos and winters in a hotel called the Menna House Hotel near the pyramids. He managed to keep her alive, not for 3 months, not for 6 months, but for an astonishing 13 years. The downside to this, or rather a further downside, was that the doctors, naturally, at the time, forbade sexual relations between the couple. So Doyle found himself in the most acutely painful and poignant situation. His wife was condemned to death. He was condemned to chastity because he was an honorable man. And so for every year that he prolonged his wife's life, he was also prolonging a curious state for a married man of extreme physical vigor in his early 30s. After 4 years of this, in 1897, the inevitable happened. He met a young woman called Jean Leckie. And this is what happened. I should say that this is a novel. And this section is particularly fictional because in his autobiography, he declined to acknowledge the truth of the meeting and the subsequent relationship with Jean Leckie. And biographers covered it up as well to a certain extent. And it is the great emotional black hole of his life, which, of course, is what attracted me as a fiction writer. We know the day that he met Jean Leckie because he promised to give her snowdrops every day, on that day for every subsequent year, and did so. But we don't know where, under what circumstances, or who introduced them. So everything is imagined. And then he meets Jean. Arthur is the first to admit that his knowledge of women is that of a gentleman rather than a cad. There were certain boisterous flirtations in his early life. There is Tui, his wife, who, over the years, became a companionable sister to him, and then, suddenly, an invalid sister. There are, of course, his real sisters. There are the statistics of prostitution, which he reads at his club. There are stories told over port, which he sometimes declines to hear. Stories involving, for instance, private rooms in discreet restaurants. There are the gynecological cases he has seen, the confinements he has attended, and the cases of disease among Portsmouth sailors and other men of low morals. His understanding of the sexual act is diverse, though related more to its unfortunate consequences than to its joyful preliminaries and processes. His mother is the only woman to whose governance he is prepared to submit. With other members of the sex, he has been variously large brother, substitute father, dominant husband, prescribing doctor, generous writer of blank checks, and Father Christmas. He is solidly content with the separation and distinction of the sexes as developed by society and its wisdom through the centuries. He is resolutely against the notion of votes for women. When a man comes home from work, he doesn't want a politician sitting opposite him at the fireside. Knowing women less, he is able to idealize them more. This is as he thinks it should be. Jean, therefore, comes as a shock to him. It is now a long time since he looked at a young woman as young men habitually do. Women, young women, it seems to him, are meant to be unformed. They are malleable, pliant, waiting to be shaped by the impress of the man they marry. They hide themselves. They watch and wait. They indulge in decorous social display, which should always fall short of coquetry, until such time as the man makes apparent his interest, and then his greater interest, and then his especial interest, by which time they are walking alone together, and the families have met, and finally he asks for her hand, and sometimes, perhaps in a last act of concealment, she makes him wait upon her answer. This is how it has all evolved, And social evolution has its laws and its necessities just as biological evolution does. It would not be thus if there were not a very good reason for its being thus. When he has introduced a gene at an afternoon tea party in the house of a prominent London Scotsman, the sort of event he normally avoids, he notices at once that she is a striking young woman. He knows from long experience what to expect. The striking young woman will ask him when he is going to write another Sherlock Holmes story, and did Holmes really die at the Reichenbach Falls, and perhaps it would be better if the consulting detective were to marry, and how did he think up such an idea in the first place? And sometimes he answers with the weariness of a man wearing five overcoats, and sometimes he manages a faint smile and replies, "Your question, young lady, reminds me why I had the good sense to drop him over the falls in the first place." But Jean does none of this. She doesn't give an agreeable start at his name or shyly confess herself a devoted reader. She asks him if he has seen the exhibition of photographs of Dr. Nansen's voyage to the far north. "Not yet, though I was present at the Albert Hall last month when he lectured to the Royal Geographical Society and received a medal from the Prince of Wales." "So was I," she replies. This is unexpected. He tells her how, after reading Nansen's account a few years previously of crossing Norway on skis, he acquired a pair of them, how from Davos he skied the high slopes of the Branger brothers. And then he begins a story, which he often tells as an adjunct to this one, about losing his skis at the top of a snow face and being obliged to come down without them, and how the strain on the seat of his tweed knickerbockers. And this really is one of his best stories, though perhaps in the present circumstances he will amend the conclusion about being happiest for the rest of the day when standing with his trouser seat to a wall. But she seems to have stopped paying attention. Taken aback, he pauses. "I should like to learn to ski," she says. This is also unexpected. "I have excellent balance. I have ridden since I was 3. Arthur is somewhat piqued at not being allowed to finish his story about tearing his knickerbockers, which includes mimicry of his tailor's assurances about the durability of Harris tweed. So he tells her firmly that it is most unlikely that women, by which he means society women as opposed to female Swiss peasants, will ever learn to ski, given the physical strength required and the dangers attendant on the activity. "Oh, I'm quite strong," she replies, "and I imagine I have better balance than you, given your size. It must be an advantage to have a lower centre of gravity, and being much less heavy, I should not do so much damage were I to fall." Had she said less heavy, he might have taken offence at such pertness. Because she says much less heavy, he bursts out laughing and promises one day to teach her to ski. "I shall hold you to it," she replies. It was all a rather extraordinary encounter, he reflects to himself in subsequent days. The way she declined to acknowledge his fame as a writer, set the subject of the conversation, interrupted one of his most popular stories, exhibited an ambition some might call unladylike, and laughed, well, as good as laughed, at his size. And yet she managed to do it all lightly, seriously, enchantingly. Arthur congratulates himself on not having taken offence, even if none was intended. He feels something is not felt for years, the self-satisfaction of the successful flirt. And then he forgets her. 6 weeks later, he walks into a musical afternoon, and she is singing one of Beethoven's Scottish songs, while an earnest little fellow in white tie accompanies her. He finds her voice superb, the pianist mannered and vain. Arthur draws back so that she won't see him observing her. After the recital, they meet in the presence of others, and she behaves with a sort of politeness which makes it difficult to judge whether she remembers him or not. They separate. A few minutes later, with some ghastly cellist groaning away in the background, they meet again, this time alone. She says at once, "I see I shall have to wait at least 9 months." "For what?" "For my skiing lesson. There is no possibility of snow now." He doesn't find this forward or flirtatious, though he knows he should. Are you planning it for Hyde Park, he asks, or St. James's, or perhaps the slopes of Hampstead Heath? Why not, wherever you wish, Scotland, or Norway, or Switzerland? They seem to have passed, without his noticing, through some French windows, across a terrace, and are now standing under that very sun which has long banished all hope of snow. He has never resented a fine day more. He looks down into her hazel green eyes. Are you flirting with me, young lady? She looks straight back at him. I'm talking to you about skiing. But those, it feels, are only her nominal words. Because if you are, be careful, I do not fall in love with you. He barely knows what he has said. He half means it entirely, and half cannot imagine what has got into him. Oh, you are already in love with me. And I with you. There is no doubt about it. No doubt at all. And so it is said, and no more words are needed or uttered for a while. All that matters is how he is to see her again, and where, and when, and it must be arranged before someone interrupts them. But he has never been a Lothario or seducer, and never known how to say those things which are necessary to arrive at the stage beyond the one where he currently stands, not really knowing either what that further stage might be, since where he is at the moment appears, in its own way, to be final. All he can feel rising up in his head are difficulties, prohibitions, reasons why they will never meet again, except perhaps decades later in passing, when they are old and grey and will be able to joke about that ever-remembered moment on someone's sunny lawn. Yet almost without his being aware of her questions and his answers, it is somehow arranged. And it is not an assignation or the start of an intrigue. It is merely the next time they will see one another. And in the 5 days he is obliged to wait, he cannot work, and he can barely think. And even if he plays 2 rounds of golf in 1 day, he finds, in the seconds between addressing the ball and bringing the club face down against it, that her face has come into his head, and his game that day is all hooks and slices and the endangering of wildlife. When he propels the ball from one sand hole directly into another, he suddenly recalls golfing at the Manor House Hotel and feeling then that he was in a perpetual bunker. Now he cannot tell whether this is still true, indeed truer than ever, with the sand even deeper and his ball buried invisibly, or whether he is somehow on the green forever. It is not an assignation, though he finds himself getting out of the cab on the corner of the street. It is not an assignation, though there is a woman of indeterminate age and class who opens the door and disappears. It is not an assignation, though they are at last alone together, sitting on a sofa covered in satin brocatel. It is not an assignation, because he tells himself it is not. He takes her hand and looks at her. Her glance is neither shy nor bold. It is frank and constant. She doesn't smile. He knows that one or the other of them must speak, but seems to have lost his daily familiarity with words. But it doesn't matter. And then she half smiles and says, I couldn't wait for the snow. I shall give you snowdrops on every anniversary of the day we met. March the 15th, she says. I know, because it's engraved upon my heart. If they cut me open, they'll be able to read that date. There is another silence. He sits there, perched on the sofa's edge, longing to concentrate on her words, her face, the date, and the thought of snowdrops. But they are all driven out by the awareness that he has the most tremendous cockstand of his entire life. It is not the decorous swelling of a pure-hearted chevalier. It is a thumping and unavoidable presence, something rowdy, something in off the street, something living up to that word, cockstand, which he has never himself uttered, but which is now pressingly in his head. His only other thought is a relief that his trousers are loosely cut. He shifts a little to ease the constriction, and in doing so, inadvertently moves a few inches closer to her. She is an angel, he thinks, her look so pure, her complexion so fair. But she has taken his movement as a sign that he intends to kiss her, and so is trustingly offering her face to his. And as a gentleman, he cannot slight her, And as a man, he cannot help himself from kissing her. Being no Lothario or seducer, but a burly, honourable man in early middle age, leaning awkwardly across a sofa, he tries to think of nothing but love and chivalry as her lips reach towards his moustache and inexpertly seek the mouth beneath it. Still holding, but now beginning to crush the hand he has held since the moment he arrives, he becomes aware of a vast and violent leakage taking place inside his trousers. And the groan he gives is almost certainly misconstrued by Miss Jean Leckie, as is the way he suddenly throws himself back from her, as if struck by an assegai between the shoulder blades. Thank you.
While the furniture is being rearranged and the microphones, I'm to tell you how the rest of the evening will progress after there are chairs and another microphone put out. And you see I'm speaking very slowly and elaborately now in order to fill the time. But Mr. Barnes and I will speak, and I will ask him some questions, which he will answer eloquently. Then you will ask him questions for another 20 minutes or so, which I expect him to answer with equal eloquence. And then I believe you may have him sign as many of his books as you would like over there in the bookstore. And I guess now we are virtually prepared to take the stage once again. Welcome to Brooklyn.
Thank you.
Clearly, even before this book, you have demonstrated an interest in the 19th century. I think of Flaubert, for instance. But you've never gone there in whole hog for a whole novel. Was writing an historical novel a formal challenge to figure out a voice that was convincingly late Victorian?
In a funny way, I don't consider it a historical novel, you see. I think of it as a contemporary novel which happens to be set 100 years ago, which may sound like sophistry, but isn't. When I came across the story, I thought, which is a story of a famous miscarriage of justice in 1903, which happened to a half-Scottish, half-Parsee solicitor in the Midlands of England, who was wrongfully accused and wrongfully convicted of mutilating a pit pony, sentenced to hard labour, whose case was subsequently taken up by Arthur Conan Doyle. When I read the details of the case, which involve, you know, police attitudes towards crime when there's a racial element to it or to one of the accused, and when I read about how the bureaucrats and the British Home Office reacted to this miscarriage of justice, I thought this could happen today. There's nothing 100 years old about this case. So that was one element of it, and the other was that I think the difference between a historical novel and a novel that happens to be set in the past is where you want the reader to be sitting. And I think, as in with a historical novel set at that time, you would somehow imagine the reader in a deep-buttoned, late Victorian tub chair with
more Sherlock Holmesian.
More Sherlock Holmesian with a glass of Madeira at his or her elbow and a blazing log fire or whatever. And I want the reader to feel that they're sitting in a sort of uncomfortable modern chair with someone's Walkman blaring in their ear or not. But, you know, but that's how I feel about the book.
But there certainly is, as in the piece of it you just read, this sense of Conan Doyle's honor, and honor as an idea figures prominently throughout the book, which I wonder if that isn't at this point something of a quaint historical artifact, or is there honor afoot as there was 100 years ago?
Oh, I think so, yes. I think it probably expresses itself rather differently. I think our sexual mores have changed completely. But I don't see that honor is... we probably wouldn't call it honor anymore. We'd call it integrity or something like that, I guess. But I think it's still going strong. Yes, but I should say to begin with that I never had an intention of writing a novel about Arthur Conan Doyle. I came across this story, which actually you mentioned teasingly my affection for France. I did actually come to this story through France. I came to it when reading about the Dreyfus case, and there was a wonderful British historian of France called Douglas Johnson, who wrote a book about the Dreyfus case. And in the introduction, he said, "It's curious that the Dreyfus case echoes down the century, whereas this case, which has many things in common with it, that's to say, a dreadful crime, a miscarriage of justice, a sentence of hard labour, expert evidence involving a handwriting specialist. In fact, the same expert was involved in both cases at one point. A racial element to it, Dreyfus being a Jew, and Adelgee, who is the George, being half Parsee, and finally a famous writer riding to the rescue, Conan Doyle here, Emile Zola there. How come the British case has been forgotten?" And Johnson, who is a very witty historian, said, "You might think that the difference was that the British case involves the mutilation of animals, whereas the French case involves high treason. But in fact, the British are probably more shocked by the mutilation of animals than they are by high treason." which, at the time, I thought, well, this is certainly one witty historian. And then after I began to reflect on it, and I remembered, I don't know if the name Anthony Blunt means much.
Indeed.
Much to you, but Anthony Blunt...
A treasonous man.
Anthony Blunt was a famous traitor, one of our most famous traitors, one of our most gilded traitors, who spied for the Soviet Union for 30 years or so and supported a Burgess and Maclean circle of spies. And he was... he was keeper of the Queen's pictures. He looked after the... He was a great expert on Poussin, a very distinguished scholar, headed the Courtauld Institute at one time, and looked after the Queen's pictures at Buckingham Palace and Windsor Castle. When he was unmasked as a... So at the very, very heart of the establishment, close to the very throne, talked to Her Madge once a week. When he was unmasked... he was allowed to continue looking after the Queen's pictures because, after all, it was only treason. Whereas, if you imagine that he'd taken a sort of knife to one of the Queen's corgis, he would have been out on his ear. It's a rather long way round to saying that I came across the case and was fascinated by it, but Conan Doyle sort of came attached to it. It could have been someone else, and I would have still taken on the job.
Conan Doyle is, unlike George Adelgee, a well-known figure, and the outlines and, in some cases, the details of his life are pretty well known. As you researched him in order to make the fictional character Arthur Conan Doyle, did you discover sides... facts about him, in addition to this black hole of his romance, that you felt you needed to bring to bear to make him something other than the sort of stock literary figure that he is?
I didn't really know anything about him before I started. You know, I knew that he'd invented Sherlock Holmes, and I'd read those stories when I was 20 or 15 to 20 or whatever. I sort of had a vague notion that he ended up being involved in a rather foolish and discreditable way with spiritualism. But that was about all I knew about him. So it was it was more a question of reading enough but not too much and then cutting back on even the little that I'd found out. I mean, it was a hard job to get George and Arthur the same weight because Arthur, so well known, written about to death. George exists barely at all. George exists as a brief character sketch in a newspaper article that Conan Doyle wrote about the case. He exists in some a few newspaper articles he wrote himself. Apart from that, his major
his major impact on the world was as the author in his mid-20s of a book on railway law. And I found myself, in trying to get a handle on what George Adelgee might have been like, reading his book on railway law and trying to deduce the character of the writer, which is quite a sort of a challenge in a way.
Which he did sell himself, as you depict him doing.
Which he did?
Sell himself almost door to door.
Yes, yes, indeed. He had flyers printed for him. Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned Conan Doyle's infamous involvement with spiritualism and psychic phenomenon. As what I take to be from your work and from some interviews, you're kind of anti-spiritualist, hyper-rationalist approach to life. What do you make of that part of Conan Doyle?
Well, I found that one of the most interesting aspects of him altogether. You are right, I'm a skeptic and a rationalist and have no religion. And I had thought of, I think the bits that I did know about Conan Doyle and spiritualism before were the famous fairy photographs, which was made into a movie about, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago. At some point in, I think, the 1920s, when he was devoted entirely to spiritualism and had bought the whole deal by that time, he authenticated some photographs taken by two teenage girls of fairies at the bottom of the garden, literally. They'd gone down to the bottom of their garden with a camera, and they'd cut out some photograph or some engravings or something from a children's encyclopedia, put them on sticks, and stuck them up and photographed them. And Doyle authenticated them without even cross-examining the girls. He was just sent the photographs, and he said, yes, this proves that his father, was a painter, and one of the things he most liked to paint was fairies, funnily enough. And then there's a whole sort of fairy culture in Victorian England, and lots of rather good fairy painters. And this... And,
for 100 years.
And Doyle said, yes, this proves that the little folk are out there. And it was rather humiliating and embarrassing. However, when I started to read up more about him, I realized that spiritualism, even if it is and always has been, how can I put this politely?
Rubbish?
Hokum, I was going to say. began, nevertheless, as an authentic... scientific investigation, and that many of the top in Britain, I don't know if it's the case in the States, but in Britain, numerous top scientists were involved in it. I mean, if we think of the people who killed off God, Voltaire, Nietzsche, Darwin, I guess, would be three of the prime candidates. When Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection was first presented, the paper was first read to the Linnaean Society in London. A paper was read at the same time, written by Alfred Russel Wallace, who simultaneously, in another part of the globe, had discovered the theory of evolution by natural selection, and Darwin insisted that this paper was read alongside his own paper. Alfred Russel Wallace became a convinced spiritualist. Not least, his argument was that that the theory of evolution explains how animals and humans developed up to a certain point, but that it doesn't explain the presence in man of what we call the soul or the spirit or however, whatever euphemism we might use for that. And he said that the evolution happened as described, but at some point some other element, call it God, must have implanted a developing breath into this clod. If we celebrated Russell rather than Darwin, we might be following a different
culture. People who discover, you know, it's the time when rare earths and rare gases were being discovered. When suddenly people were becoming aware, scientists were becoming aware that just beneath the skin of things there was more going on than we'd imagined, and so it was sort of plausible that that perhaps the same might operate in the spiritual world, and you know, telepathy seemed to work, for example. The Society of Psychical Research was there to actually weed out fraud and to try and establish a sort of basis, some sort of scientific basis for on which a certain advance in thinking could be made, which might in the end lead to being able to prove that that the spirit continued after death, and that spirits could communicate with us. So Doyle took it seriously, absolutely seriously, and I take it seriously in the book too. I mean, I think it would have been too tempting to ironize it. And also, you see, it ties in. That was one of the points when I realized that this story that I'd found had a fictional depth to it. When you're talking about crime and the administration of justice, you're talking about what we think happened, what we believe happened, and then at a certain point, it's what you can prove happened, what you know happened. It's the same, the second layer of the story is in the emotional life, which comes later in the Doyle part of the story, but you think you love someone, you believe they love you. How can you know they do? And can you ever prove it? Those words keep recurring in the book, and then and then the final layer, the ultraviolet layer, is the spiritual layer. In conventional religion, you think there's a God, you believe there's a God, but can you ever know there's a God, let alone prove that there's a God? Well, Conan Doyle, in his boldness, thought it was possible to know and prove. Unfortunately, he tipped over as the years went by into believing anything.
In that sense, in that boldness of being, his confidence about being able to know and prove, of course, he seems like maybe the last great 19th century man. And speaking of the 19th century, I've read that you collect Dickens, among many other books. You have yet to publish the book. Well, among the books I'm waiting for you to write, which is your big, sprawling Dickensian story, rather than these beautiful, perfect, rather compact stories. Is that somewhere in the...
Is this big enough for you or not?
Not quite.
I don't want to write a Dickensian novel. I want to write a Barnesian novel.
Well, which gets to my next question. What is a Barnesian novel? Your books are so breathtakingly diverse in genre and tone and form. It is hard to say what one is. They clearly all have, and I'll leave France aside until a little later again, but all of them, I guess, could be described as novels of ideas, and none of them, so far as I know, are humorless. How would you describe a Julian Barnes novel in 25 words or less? Or make it 50.
Do I get a prize?
You do.
I don't know. One of the happy things about being a writer is you don't have to describe yourself, really, or you don't have to look at yourself in the way that other people look at you. You don't have to think, or at any rate, I find it harmful and unhelpful to think about my work, let alone that one French word I will never use of myself, my oeuvre. as any sort of totality, you know. I can only write one book at a time, and I can only write that book by forgetting all the previous ones that I've written. And I'm sort of aware, because people keep telling me that my books are different from one another, and I don't know where I'm going next, except it's not where I've just been. But that's sort of how I am. I think I'm going to avoid your question.
But, well, you haven't entirely, and is your impulse to keep yourself interested? Is that that's why you?
No, it's how I've always. I mean, you know, when I suppose when I started off, I thought part of writing more than one novel is teaching yourself how to write a novel, and so I had what I thought what was a sort of plan. That's to say, my first novel was going to be in the first person. My second novel was going to be in the third person. My third novel was going to be from the point of view of a woman. Well, parts one and two worked. Then part three got sidelined for a bit because Flaubert's Parrot came along. So part three went into part four. But this was as much of a sort of a plan as I ever had. But that involved...
That's quite a plan. That's quite a strategy.
Well, I don't think it's... I don't think I could exactly sell it for much money to to aspiring writers. But at the start, I was sort of aware that you want to learn to be a writer, which involves doing lots of different things. But it's obviously much more than that in my case. I can't explain it because I don't want to look at it. If you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. It's why many artists don't wish to go to psychiatrists, I guess.
Yes, it? I mean, John Cleese went to one, and he explained exactly why he had this impulse to be funny, and so he stopped.
we don't want you to stop, so I won't pursue this any further. Flaubert's Parrot, you also have published a book of stories called Cross Channel about France. You have a book of essays called Something to Declare, that is about France.
Mm-hmm.
You translated a French writer's account of his syphilis called In the Land of Pain. You now, I see, have done radio shows about Rudyard Kipling's love of France.
Mm. Yeah.
What compels you?
Oh, I want to irritate George Bush. It was the first country I went to. My parents were French teachers. Unlike children today, in those days, it was quite rare for children, even in adolescence, to go abroad.
Even just across the channel?
Even just across the channel, yes. I mean, I remember the incredible exoticism of a boy when I was in the sixth form, so I would have been 16, say. And I can. It was such an exotic thing to do, and obviously showed his parents were so fantastically rich and cosmopolitan that I can remember the boy's name. It was John Marsilia, and he went to America. This would have been in 1962 or so, and he came back with a sheepskin-lined jacket and a copy of The Carpetbaggers. Amazing what America was full of, we thought. But I went to France with my parents on an annual holiday from the ages of about 13 to 17 or 18 or so. I didn't go to another foreign country until I was 18, 19, something like that. But this was completely normal. So France was my primary exotic. It was the place where things were different. It was also the place where that difference made me think about my own country. If my parents had been Italian teachers, I would have been writing Dante's Gerbil or something like that rather than...
There's an idea.
Yeah. It's strange, you know, life is a set of forking paths, isn't it, as someone must have said.
Well, I know you haven't written, as far as I know, Dante's Gerbil, but I discovered in my research that you have written several novels that I doubt many people in this room have heard of, including a book called Duffy and a book called Going to the Dogs.
That's right, yes.
Tell me about that, this secret life.
It's not very secret. It's only secret because no one ever bought them. I had a secondary literary persona as a thriller writer when I started off. I used to read a lot of crime fiction, and my first novel called Metroland took me, I think, about 8 years to write, which you might, reading it, think rather unnecessary period of time to spend on it.
But then, you know, no one, there's no way of, there's no easy way of becoming a writer, or there wasn't then. I don't think there is still. And that's how long it took me. When I'd finished it, I thought, oh, well, why don't I try and write a thriller? And I wrote one in called Duffy in 2 weeks. And then the following year, I wrote another one, and it took me 2.5 weeks. And eventually, I wrote four. And then I found that thriller they all had sort of running characters. And at first, this was a great liberation. And then secondly, it was a constriction, and that actually I thought, oh God, when I invented this character Duffy, realized he didn't like going abroad, so I can't, you know, he's afraid of flying or something. So he can't, you create a character, you give him various characteristics, and then you're stuck with them if you don't think ahead.
And then you throw him over the falls.
That's the trouble. So I threw him over the falls. No, I mean, the fact was that I was writing thrillers and I was writing novels under my own name. And everyone assumed that my thriller writing was supporting my, in quotes, art novels like Flaubert's Parrot. But in fact, Flaubert's Parrot was supporting my crime fiction because they really didn't sell very well, the Dan Kavanagh novels. So I stopped writing them.
Do you think consciously as you, or did you as you began, do you today think of, oh, I'm writing this one more for the market, I'm writing this one more for the art, for the esteem?
No, because you see, when I started, I mean, you never know how a book is going to do, as proved by the, well, I mean, they may not have been very good thrillers. Maybe that's why they didn't have much of a following. But
Flaubert's Parrot may not have looked like the most commercial book in the world when you wrote it.
Flaubert's Parrot has sold very well over the years, and I like it very much for that reason, if none other. But when I was writing it and trying to describe it to people, I once made the mistake of describing it to the British novelist Kingsley Amis, who I knew at that time. And it was a mixture of furious boredom and an apoplectic rage came into it. I found myself saying, well, it's sort of an upside down sort of novel. It's about Flaubert and France, and he was sort of and then I tried it on my publisher and got blank looks back. So I was sort of rather surprised that it actually did what it did. But you know, you just write the book that you want to and you have to, and then you see how it goes.
And you steadfastly refuse to look at your oeuvre as an oeuvre, but do you find yourself looking over your shoulder at this set of British novelists almost precisely your age, all of whom are celebrated, including Barton Amis and Ian McEwan and Salman Rushdie?
No, they're looking over their shoulders. I know all of them, and I admire most of them. And you know, I think of them individually as they probably think of me, that some of their books are better than others. You know, we don't like that thought of us, but it's the truth. I get on with them, and I admire them, and so on and so forth, and mumble.
But you don't track your reputation as the others fall.
I think that way lies madness. You do see writers, you know. Was it Berryman who said, someone will know the correct story, but I would guess it was someone like Robert Frost died, and Berryman's response was, who's number one? Cal's number one, isn't he? Something like that. I think it was Berryman of Lowell. And I thought...
And that way did lie madness in his particular
that
case.
That way, that for all of them, probably. But, so I think you have to, the ones that you should look over your shoulder at are the great ones from the past, you know, and they give you enough trouble by their greatness.
And there's no hope of them writing a bad book and
oh, but they do.
Falling behind you.
No. Well, come on. There are bad Shakespeare plays.
But no new bad Shakespeare plays.
That is true. Well, actually, I'm not sure that is true, because every so often they discover something new that is by Shakespeare.
True enough.
And if it's bad, it's not by him. Or sometimes it is, you know. And that sort of looking at them over your shoulder keeps you straight, keeps you honest. And I do occasionally feel base emotions about certain people.
No.
Yeah, I do. But, you know, not really.
I would now invite any members of the audience who have questions for Julian Barnes to ask them. Many people do. Yes, ma'am. I'm supposed to repeat questions, but your voice is so beautiful that I feel I'm being redundant. The question was simply the writer Julian Barnes, the brand, I guess Julian Barnes, more or less, versus the personal, the human being Julian Barnes, and what obligations to reveal the personal do you feel?
I don't have any obligations to reveal the personal, and I draw quite a clear line, which I don't cross. Other people may cross it, and there's nothing I can do about that. But I'm not a writer who is autobiographical in the main, and therefore I don't feel that my private self is up for discussion. I mean, it's a mixture of aesthetic belief. It's Flaubertianism on the one hand. Flaubert said it might perhaps be very enjoyable to express my opinions in a novel and relieve Monsieur Gustave Flaubert of his feelings. But what would be the point of that? It's partly aesthetic principle, and it's partly my reticent nature, I'd say.
Yeah.
At the risk of sounding sycophantic here for a moment, I mean, one of the things I love about your work, beyond the beautiful prose, is your ability to really get inside and around the character. And in this last book, one of the ones that struck me remarkably was the assistant to Doyle.
Mr. Wood.
Yeah. And what was amazing about it was not just him, but the perspective that it gave you on Doyle, and particularly on his relationship with Jean Levy. And you even remarkably in this book spoke about how somebody conceives a character historically when you're reflecting on this. How do you do that?
I love this question. I don't know. You spend a long time being a novelist, and with a bit of luck, you get better. I don't know. I mean, Mr. Wood, Alfred Wood, who was Conan Doyle's secretary, assistant, golf partner, gopher, companion, who went on a bit of the investigation with him. I knew nothing about him at all except a photograph. And in a way, you know, just as it was somewhat easier to write George, of whom very, very little was known, than Arthur, of whom too much was known, I just found myself looking at this photograph of this guy and thinking in a rather sort of, utilitarian or that's not quite the word I mean, but... I thought, I can use you. I thought, you can. You're definitely going to... I don't know quite how, but you've got your part.
The remarkable thing you did was to reflect rather, or just sort of delicately, pejoratively,
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes. Well, I thought that in that sort of household where you have a sort of male retainer, companion, chum, though always in a position of employment, when the first wife gives way to the second wife, there's likely to be tension between two such people, and the one would always behave correctly but would have his private thoughts. And then at a certain point, liquor is taken and some of his private thoughts come out. But yes.
The question is about in this book, the tenses changing at a crucial moment in the story, and how was that decision made?
Unwilling as I am to deny being French in any way, I'm not sure that it came. I mean, you know, you don't quite know what your influences are at that level of writing. I don't think I had any French model or anything in mind. I began to think of the way of distinguishing the voices and the character at the beginning, and what sort of stage of their life and the story they were going through. And I found myself, I don't know if it played here, but you know that great German made for television series Heimat, has that been shown?
No.
It's made by a man called Edgar Rice, and it's absolutely superb, and it lasts about 30 hours or 60 hours or something like that. But at a certain point, it's shot in black and white, and then every so often it goes into colour, which I know is a technique other filmmakers have used, but I was thinking particularly of his use. And I thought, is there a prose way of changing the emphasis in some way, which isn't as going from monochrome into colour is actually quite a startling change in a film. I wanted something less, you know, quieter than that. And so it struck me that there would be times. It opens with Arthur being in the past tense because Arthur is the established figure, the known figure. George is in the present tense because his story starts later in actual time, and B, because that is still potential, that still can change. At a certain point when George steps into history, when he becomes accused and his name is in the papers and so on, he moves into history and goes into the past tense. And at around that time, Arthur goes into the present tense because Arthur meets Jean. The section I read, and then he meets Jean, is the moment at which Arthur's story goes into the present tense, because, and Jean is always, all the sections with Jean are in the present tense, because love is in the present tense. So, but I hesitate to sort of, this makes it sound more
strategically
theoretical. Strategically planned. In fact, things like this are a question of feel, you know? And you think I think I can get the right effect and the reader's slight shift in closeness or viewpoint by doing it this way, and then you sort of begin to do it yourself almost instinctively, and then at certain points there are clear strategic decisions to make. I mean, not to give away the ending, but there's a sort of grand final scene which starts in the present, and then at a certain point George walks into a blazing hall where things are about to, the final scene is about to happen, and at that moment he walks into the present tense as well. So it was about focus, I guess you could say, changing the focus. But I can't. Did you have a particular French novel in mind?
I was thinking,
She did. This is worrying. No. Well, I think I am to say a few of my 50 words about myself. I'm very interested in form and what form can do, and I think that some novelists are inclined to neglect form and to think that form is easy, or that form consists of starting the story at the beginning and going on till it ends. That form is the form of the novel is just like the form of an anecdote but larger, you know, and I think there's lots more to it than that. Oh yes, absolutely. I mean people like Perec, who you were alluding to, the French being so adorably French do sometimes push it to an extreme. I mean, you know, Perec wrote a novel, wrote a full-length novel without using the letter E. And it seems to me that at a certain point there's a technical or formal challenge to writing which is kind of pointless, you know. I mean, I don't see what extra benefits it got except a sort of tremendous self-satisfaction at pulling it off, and a tremendous irritation to his translators about from anything else.
Yes, sir. The question about the proper place of fiction and nonfiction, whether memoirs should be allowed to be fictionalized. Of course, I mean, you've written novels like The History of the 10.5 Chapters, which combine very clearly and pointedly nonfiction with embedded in your fiction. Do you have an opinion about whether or not memoirs should be true?
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, I know I'm obviously not quite up to speed as you are about this case, though. I was in my publisher's this afternoon, and there was almost no one working because they were all clustered around television screens looking at Oprah Winfrey.
Yeah. They watch Oprah at Knopf? I'm shocked, really.
Well, I think one of their imprints published the book.
Ah, well, there you go. Indeed, it did.
Not Knopf who published me, but
is
one
it
of the other ones.
Yes,
I think.
Right.
I'm not quite sure who it was. I don't know. It's a sort of it does come up occasionally, doesn't it? That it only comes up when the book is very successful. It strikes to me, you know. Autobiographers. I mean, a lot of autobiographers are liars anyway. I mean, I remember giving up reading Benvoluto Cellini's autobiography because I thought, this isn't true, you know. You're just a blagger, you know. You may be a great goldsmith and a great silversmith, but I don't believe this. I gave up Casanova's memoirs for the same reason. I thought, I don't believe a word of this, you know. Get away with you, I thought.
So relativism has a long, venerable history.
So I think, yes. But I do think, you know, I think that if you do write an autobiography, you have a moral duty to tell, obviously you can't, if you're writing about your childhood, you're going to get things wrong or people are going to disagree with you. Book I'm writing at the moment, I've been emailing my brother, who's 3 years older than me, about things
in my early childhood, our early childhood, and we have completely different memories. And but it's made worse, of course, by the fact that he's a philosopher. And when I rebuked him for something, he said, "But you see, I think all memories are false." He said. So this is his starting point. So rather difficult for us to see eye to eye completely about things.
Is it a memoir you're writing, but, or is this research for?
No, I'm not telling you what it is. I'm sorry. It's something different. It's something. It's a new departure. It's called A New Departure.
You're teasing, man. You.
But, of course, you can't remember dialogue exactly. The dialogue that you know, when we retell stories, we improve the dialogue all the time. And our best stories are often the stories that we have most worked on and made into stories. But I do think that if you are writing a memoir or an autobiography, you have a moral duty to the reader to make it as truthful as you possibly can. And that, you know, I'm an Orwellian in this respect. Of course, 100% objective truth is impossible, but you know, if we get to 60%, it's better than 50 and much better than 40. You know, we should crank up those percentages as much as we possibly can. I should have gone on Oprah.
Exactly. I mean, hear, hear.
I pray to her nightly.
Well, perhaps this departure about your childhood could work for you.
It's also what always comes up is that people have made their childhood sound worse than it was. I'm going to write an autobiography in which I make my childhood sound better. Yes. I think that would be a provocative.
Well,
mood.
These French teachers who gave you half of your subject, I guess, is what it would be about. We have time for one more question, madam. When did you decide you wanted to be a writer? Who had been your influences, and what would you tell young aspiring writers?
That's not one question. That's not a final question. That's about half an hour. I wasn't one of those children who was scribbling infuriatingly under the bed sheets at night with a torch or anything like that. In adolescence, I thought I wanted to be a reader, you know, a good reader, which I suppose is not a bad training ground for being a writer eventually. I started trying to do something in my early mid-20s, but I had I had very little self-confidence, and I didn't think, you know, if you spend your adolescence and first years of your 20s reading great literature, you think, what authority do I have to add to the pile that's there already, you know? And you could say, what's changed, mate? I think when I was about 25, I started to write a sort of non-fiction anecdotal type of thing, which is now locked away somewhere. And I started writing bits of journalism as well. And though Cyril Connolly cast journalism as one of the enemies of promise, I found it helpful in that I would write a short piece and it would come out and someone might read it and they wouldn't point at me in the street and say, you can't be a writer, you're not allowed to be a writer. So sort of negative approval happened. Or negative non-approval or whatever. And then I sort of thought, well, I'll give it a go. And, of course, you know, you start off thinking no one's going to see it, so it doesn't really matter. I don't know what advice I would give except only do it if you really want to do it. Only do... don't give up. Only do it if it gives you pleasure in the most serious use of the word.
and about five other instructions, and then the final one would be, but don't take any notice of elderly writers telling you how to write and what to do.
Speaking of being elderly, I noticed in my research that your birthday was last week. Happy birthday.
Thank you
very much. I want to thank you.
And thank you for not saying what it was.
Thank you, Julian Barnes.